good session.
Thanks, man.
Cheers.
See you there.
Let's go. Welcome back to another episode of LifeSight AI, the podcast series. And we are well underway with series 5. And as you'll notice, this is the second in-person one that we have had. This is also a very special episode because we are joined by the CTO of one of our really strong partners, Brainomics, Eric Grieveson. So welcome.
Thanks.
So the second time Brainomics have been on the podcast as well. They were actually the very, very first guests back in, I think we recorded late 2020 and it was released early 2021. So two and a most years later, almost 3 years later,
yep.
Be good to see where you've gone in your journey and also learn very much around sort of new markets, hiring, because you've increased your hiring quite a lot, increased your headcount quite a lot in the last 3 years as well. So
that's right.
Absolute pleasure to have you join us on the podcast, Eric. And
yeah,
I'll leave you to introduce yourself in a bit more detail and Brainomics.
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, so yeah, my colleague Olivier was on about 2.5 years ago, I think. So it's nice to come back. So my name's Eric. I'm the CTO of Brainomics. So I look after the R&D team and also our kind of systems engineering operations team as well as our QA and RA function. So I've managed to divest myself of our field operations, but still quite a lot going on. So yeah, as you say, we've now got about 70 people in the company, I think. So about half of that is in the R&D and QA RA side of things. So getting quite big now, a lot of changes over the last year and a half. And looking forward to chatting a bit about all of those changes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, probably good to give a bit of a overview firstly of where you were when, obviously, you know, Olivier spoke and where you are now. Because back then you were, you know, 20 person company, I think it was probably headcount wise.
That's right.
Had, your e-stroke device in the market to a large extent. Know, but we've always talked, my uncle uses you guys, so it's always a personal one.
Yeah, that's always good, yeah.
But a lot's changed. So in terms of, like, I guess, product suites and where you are now, give us an update in the last 2 years.
Well, yeah, for those who didn't listen into the very first episode, I'm sure there are very few people in that situation, but I'll go right back to the start. So the company was actually founded in 2010 by five co-founders, including our CEO, Michalis Papadakis. He was the preclinical director of the preclinical stroke lab director in Oxford, and he saw that there was this need for imaging interpretation within stroke medicine. So his boss, Alistair Buchan, was the inventor of something called the Aspect Score, which is a kind of a systematic way of looking at non-contrast CT scans for stroke patients. And Michalis saw an opportunity to make an automated system to help doctors interpret these scans, which are quite difficult to do visually. And so he formed the company back in 2010. They got a grant from what was then the Technology Strategy Board, now Innovate UK. And by 2012, they'd done a phase one project to kind of do a feasibility study and develop a business plan, essentially. And then in the phase two round of that funding, that's where I came on board. So I was the first technical person within the company. The rest of the co-founders were from the kind of science and clinical side and business development. But they needed a software developer, an engineer, to look at this. Now, I came on back in 2013, once that second round of funding came through, to develop the first product that we had, which was called eAspects. Unsurprisingly, a kind of automated version of the Aspect Score. And within a year and a half, so by April 2015, we had that as a regulatory cleared product in Europe. And that was a really big learning experience for me personally, because I'd never worked in medical imaging before. So I had a lot to learn. There was a whole kind of new suite of tools, formats, technologies that I needed to get up to speed with and understand kind of the clinical context as well as building the team from those early days. So essentially, we started off with eAspects in April 2015. A couple of years later, we released eCTA, which was to look at CT angiograms, again for stroke patients. And we then moved on to CT perfusion, which was released, I think, in 2020. And then we now have an MRI solution as well. So we have a full suite of stroke products. It's now called Brainomics 360. That's cleared for the EU market. The MRI module is still for research use. And then we're actually going into the US now. So this year alone, we've had five or six regulatory clearances for 510Ks in the USA, which means we can start going into that new market.
Yeah. Brilliant. And I think that the US piece we'll discuss towards the end of the episode or second half. But one thing I wanted to pick up on, and something that we've discussed previously as well, first technical person in a medical imaging in a company didn't do medical imaging.
That's right.
So what was the differences that you had to learn? Initially when you joined Brainomics and you joined this new sector?
Yeah, so I started off with an engineering degree back in, I can almost remember, 2006. So that was a kind of general engineering degree, but I specialized in software engineering and computer vision in particular. And I then spent some years working for various companies, mostly in the startup phase, doing algorithm engineering. So looking at, for example, extracting white road markings and road signs from videos taken from vans for highway asset surveying. Very exciting stuff. Yeah, doing some kind of 3D mapping from unmanned aerial vehicle kind of surveillance. So doing video cameras from these drones and then making 3D models and so on from that. So I had quite a lot of background in the kind of computer vision, machine learning side of things. I actually did have a tiny, tiny bit of medical imaging experience just before I joined Brainomics. I did a consulting project for a company based up in Edinburgh, where I was living at the time. And they now have quite a successful platform, and they needed something to basically translate from one format to another. So a Java library to a kind of C library to do an integration project they were working on. So while I didn't really know anything about the medical imaging format, that was a good place to start and actually learn some of the very basics about DICOM, which is the standard format for medical imaging. So that was kind of the way I got into it. And then when I started at Brainomics, I had all of this new stuff to learn. So as you can imagine, there was a lot of technology to learn. So DICOM, medical imaging. I had a bit of an idea of what I'd do in terms of the machine learning, the image processing side of things, but actually understanding the formats of CT scans, which is the kind of imaging that we process, and the clinical context. What do doctors need from it? What's the actual problem that we're trying to solve? Why is it a problem for doctors at the moment? Is all really important when designing a product for the first time. And the co-founders already had an idea about that, but they didn't have any idea of the technical details. A smart thing to do would have been to hire some people with a background in medical imaging to help out. But obviously I was young and naive, so I got some other very good software engineers, but who hadn't got any experience in that area. So we hired a kind of software engineer who'd come from a Formula One background and motorsport and some communication stuff as well. He's still our head of software engineering. And we also had a UI developer working on a contract, which was the initial team to build eAspects. Now, none of us really had a clue about medical imaging, so it was my job, along with Michalis, the CEO, to really define what the product should be and how we would implement that. And there's several ways that we can kind of think about learning this. And for this kind of domain knowledge, we had access to the co-founders. So Iris Grunwald was a neuroradiologist. She could explain a bit about how she worked, about medical imaging, but we didn't have that much access to her. She was only available for a day every few weeks or so. So that was a bit tricky. Obviously, lots of resources online, especially now. There's so much you can learn online, especially from the technical side of things. There's references that you can read and you know, documentation on standards and so on. You can get a bit of an idea from that, but it's not going to give you a full picture, really. There's books. Some of the kind of stroke unit setting up books were actually written by our co-founders. So Iris had written a book, How Do You Set Up a Stroke Unit? So that kind of thing can be useful. But what I found the most useful is actually going on site to hospitals, which is much more difficult these days, post-COVID. But back then, we had the right contacts to be able to go into hospitals, just see what people were doing, actually look at a stroke unit, the pathway, where a CT scan happens, all of those kind of things. And that's really important to get a good idea of the context of the problem and the kind of frustrations that physicians have and where we might be able to add value to their pathway.
And definitely, I think the challenge is when someone has, you know, an amazing idea of where technology can feed into health and healthcare system, no matter where it kind of wants to integrate to, is what's it going to do in the workflow of the clinician? You know, is it going to be quicker for them ultimately in theory, but how well can they integrate it into their workflow right now?
Exactly.
Being sort of separate from the clinical workflow, because you're, you know, innovating in a startup environment, you're not in the healthcare business, is, I can imagine, very, very challenging. So what were the sort of the key things when you were trying to validate the workflow that you were looking for in terms of the questions, the data points that really made the e-aspect successful when you were then creating the product?
Yeah. So I think the first thing is getting a triangulated viewpoint rather than just relying on one hospital or one physician, because what it turns out that everybody has different ways of working. When we're in healthcare, just focusing on one country often isn't enough. If you want to have a sustainable business, you need to go beyond just the UK, for example. And if you go to Germany, they have very different ways of working to the NHS, who have very different ways of working to French doctors versus US doctors and so on. So there's a lot of variety out there, different imaging modalities available, different treatments available even. So having as broad an experience as possible is good to try and pick up on common themes. And just being able to chat with physicians and ask them what they're doing when they're interpreting CT scans. For us, it's focusing on the imaging. Okay, what are you looking at in the imaging? What do you find difficult? Do you think this kind of software can help? And with all of these things, it's much easier to do that if you've got something that they can look at and play with. So prototypes are obviously very important. One of our main objectives was to have a prototype up and running for kind of research purposes within the first 9 to 12 months of the project. So we managed to do that, and then that helped us do not only our clinical study for regulatory clearance, but also gave us a bit of idea of, is it working the way it should do? What are the kind of pushbacks we're going to get from physicians? And I think it's fair to say that we've been iterating on e-aspect ever since then for the last nearly, well, 10 years now. So yeah, there's always improvements to be made. New technology comes along, new techniques come along, people with new ideas come along, and you can always make improvements. So it's having that iterative development process, being as close to the customer as possible. Yeah. And there's a huge kind of communication barrier if the developers have to rely on other people to tell them what problem is to be solved rather than actually seeing it with their own eyes. There's so many small decisions as a software developer that you have to make every day that you'll be able to have an idea in your head of what you think will be useful to the customer. If you always have to go back to, for example, a product manager or a clinician to say, is this going to be useful? Then it slows down the process. And really, if you've internalized as much of that knowledge as possible, then it gives you a big advantage, I think.
Yeah, and I think there's been many success stories that we've also featured on the podcast series around people who involved clinicians very, very early on. My memory goes back to Gleema and how they were successful having clinicians part of their teams for each product very early on and being there as an advisory point of view. So not everyone is as lucky to have that access as Gleema did, or have co-founders, I guess, like yourselves.
Yeah.
So what sort of type of individual, looking back now, obviously you have a fantastic team right now, but what type of individual, if someone is spinning out or with an early imaging company, do they need to be looking at to enable that link to the customer early doors?
Yeah, so as you say, I think we had an advantage of having the kind of clinical side in the founding team. The downside of that was that there was no engineering side, which was kind of good for me in a way. But if you're coming at it from the other side, so you've got an engineering background, the first thing you have to validate is, are you a solution looking for a problem? Or do you really understand a problem and you think you found a solution to it? And so hopefully you know that there's a problem, you've identified a problem, and that typically would come from some domain knowledge. Now, if you're an outsider and you need to get into this business, obviously there are consultants available. If you've raised money, you might be able to start paying for people with a lot of knowledge to come on board and help out with that. Doctors, if they're interested in the problem, might be interested in a part-time relationship. So we have some people who are very good within our company, in our translational medicine department, who actually work kind of 50% in the NHS, 50% for the company, which is a really good relationship. And I think going to trade shows is very important. You can meet lots of people there, you can see what's being talked about in the industry, and you can pick up a lot of knowledge quickly from going to trade shows. In our case, things like stroke conferences, where you have neurologists and stroke physicians talking about the latest treatments and latest diagnosis pathways, or even radiology conferences. There's a big one in the US called RSNA, yeah, which is very expensive to go to, but always worthwhile.
I've yet to convince our CFO to send me on a plane. Every year I make the request.
It's always worth a try. Yeah, my colleagues are in Miami at the moment at a stroke conference, so I've missed out as well.
Yeah, it's a tough life. But I think that sort of early engagement is absolutely key. And then moving on to the last, what's been a very busy 18, 24 months, obviously you had an influx of funding. Is it Series B officially?
So we've had our Series B a couple of years ago, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And that has led to a growth from about, as I said, around 20 to 70 odd now. And looking at the engineering team specifically, because you have also have, as I said, a lot of other streams which you've picked up now, and
that's right.
You managed to not have some as well. When we brief on roles, not just with yourself, but with other companies in this space, because a lot of what they're doing and what you're doing is cutting edge, there aren't too many people that are, you know, ahead of you, and therefore there aren't too many people to nick from other projects that are like for likes and,
that's right,
and such like. So I think a lot of the time when we speak, it's always, you know, what flex can we have if we haven't got domain knowledge?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of your team, and even including yourself, didn't have domain knowledge.
That's right.
When you joined. So for those people looking to build teams in this space, if you haven't got the comfort and the safeguard of domain knowledge as an engineer or other, you know, product or whatnot that you might want to be hiring for, what are the key things that you would look for in that person to be successful in a software medical device company?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question. There's some things that you can kind of tell. I've had people come into interviews without having visited our website, which is, you know, quite impressive, but you know, some interest in the company. It's amazing how even just like a bit of initiative and background research can really give you a leg up over other candidates, I think. Mm-hmm. If somebody has a real interest in the field, so we're quite lucky in that medical imaging is an interesting area, both technically and from the kind of social good perspective. It's really good kind of crossover for us. We essentially find that lots of candidates have a lot of desire to learn, which is a really good sign, but maybe they haven't done the background reading yet themselves. So maybe they just need a few pointers to where to go, what to read up on, maybe academic papers to read. And when we have new staff coming on board, we want to see that kind of eagerness to learn, the ability to do research, which is often well demonstrated by people with a PhD, for example. They've had to do that already and go off on their own initiative and learn about a subject. And that's also very important to have allied with the strong technical background, because that's not something that's easy to teach within, you know, even several years. Hopefully somebody's got a relevant degree in a suitable kind of biomedical engineering or software engineering or perhaps computer science background. So having the technical knowledge is our number one kind of priority when hiring somebody. I can give you a bit of detail about our interview process, for example. So we typically try to advertise a fairly clear list of desirable skills, and that includes the technical skills, but also the softer skills, and also the kind of work that somebody would be responsible for as well. So you'd understand a bit about what your role would involve and what you would be responsible for and what you wouldn't necessarily be responsible for. So hopefully that gets some good candidates through. We can review the CVs, check that they seem to be matching the skills and demonstrating some of those in previous roles. Not so important for more junior hires, of course, but certainly more important for the kind of mid-level and senior roles. And then we'll typically have a couple of stages of interview where we first of all set a technical challenge. So this will be maybe writing a very small software program to solve a problem that is relevant to the area we're working in, but really can show off their technical skills. And then we'll have a face-to-face interview Sometimes we can do those remotely, especially for overseas candidates. But as usual, it's best to have these in person. And then we can get a bit more into the detail of discussing the problem. So we can see what their response is when challenged on certain points that they've made. And it's always good to be able to have that kind of interactive discussion, especially in a difficult, complicated technical environment where we've got difficult problems to solve every day. You're going to have different opinions of the right approach to take, and it's good to be able to have that dialogue. But also to see just generally how they interact with the other team members, what kind of differences they can even bring to the team, because I think having a diverse team is really important. So you get different viewpoints, even different backgrounds, give people different ideas, and we really benefit from that when we have a mixture of viewpoints and different ways of looking at a problem.
Yeah, I think cognitive diversity is really important, and you know, different lived experiences is something that I've spoken about at London Tech Week this year and on other sort of conferences, and how you're building an engineering team, especially when it's a software medical device, because people come at it from a purpose-led point of view. People come at it from, not coming from the background.
Yeah.
And so, if you were to look at an engineering CV, and say it's a software engineer,
yeah,
what would you want to see on it in terms of principles of programming, or previous experience, for you to be comfortable that they could step into a highly regulated environment?
Yeah. So I think for me, the first thing when looking at a CV is it well summarized and concise? If I get a 20-page CV, I'm going to be quite sad. Not just because it's going to be a lot to read through, but also because it shows that communication might not be one of the candidate's strong points.
Yeah.
And I think being able to communicate and summarize complex ideas and get key messages across is really important, even for junior level engineers.
Yeah.
So first of all, is there a good summary of their latest roles, their key skills, and their educational background?
Mm-hmm.
That can just be one page,
yeah,
maybe two pages, but hopefully not too much more than that. And then in the last couple of roles, what have they really been working on day to day? And I don't want a listing of every technology that they've worked on, you know, like Git, HTML, JavaScript, all that kind of thing. It can be useful to know. It's something nice to put down the main things that you feel comfortable with. But what I'd mostly be looking for is working within a kind of general software development process, an understanding of the greater process.
Yeah.
So how do you test your code? How do you react to requirements? How do you challenge requirements? How do you, resolve conflicts with other developers, that kind of thing. So on a CV, it's about writing a bit about the projects you've worked on, what your contribution to the project was, and especially, I think, what you're looking to do next. Because somebody saying, I'd really love to start working in medical imaging, and I think Brainomics is a great environment to do this because I'm really excited about this product, that's fantastic. Showing some interest in the company is actually a level above what most candidates will do.
Yeah, I think also then past that is you know, demonstrating actionable things that they've done as well. So you know,
absolutely,
researching and bringing some ideas on the product, and very early on, engineers will look at websites and things like that and give their take on it. And
yeah,
so that's always nice to engage on it and stuff.
This is actually something that we see salespeople tend to do very well. So I've done a few kind of sales interviews as well within the team. And you'll find that often good salespeople will come and say, well, I've done a bit of due diligence on Brainomics. I've talked to your customer here. I've talked to a consultant of yours over here. And that's really good to see, because that shows that they've really put the time in to understand a bit more about the company, and shows that they've gone to that extra level of trouble, which I don't think I've ever seen a technical hire do. But if I did, I'd be very impressed with that.
Do you think, though, because those salespeople tend to be within the ecosystem?
It can be, but it's also the kind of thing that can be done even from somebody outside the ecosystem. So doing a bit of research online, I mean, these days with things like LinkedIn and social media and so on, it's very easy to get an idea of who's been working with the company, and even just to send a message to somebody and say, hey, I was really interested in this company, what do you think about them, is something that most people are happy to answer and can be really useful.
No, fair enough. So anyone wanted to join, go and speak to Eric.
Exactly,
and ask
him
what it's like.
Always happy to chat, yeah.
That's wicked. And so when you're looking at the team now and your journey as well in your career, question first off is, did you think you would be managing a team as diverse as this when you first started Brainomics? And what has been the leadership journey that you specifically gone on to manage this sort of cross-functional streams in not always engineering?
Yeah. So I think the first part, I never really had a very detailed like 10-year plan or anything like that. I'd always worked in typically reasonably small software teams, although some companies of around 100 to 200 people, but usually within kind of startups within those companies. So I was slightly experienced at managing a small software team, but not as a CTO level. Yeah. So coming in at the start, it was very much in my comfort zone. I was one person leading a three-person team, essentially, so something I was used to. But then the growth and where we are today isn't something that I was necessarily imagining would happen. Yeah. And some of the things that have happened along that journey include transformations in the way you work, because it's a very different scenario being able to sit at a desk with, well, I think we were sharing one desk, all three of us, at one point. And you can have a chat about any problems you're working on. Yeah. Everybody knows everything about what's going on in the company in a way. When you're 70 people in a company, that's not possible. So being able to set up those communication pathways, make sure everybody's clear on the responsibilities that they have, also what the overall company targets are and what's important, is really difficult.
Yeah.
So even though we spend quite a lot of time communicating, here's our main priorities, it can be very difficult for somebody at the coalface to be able to say, why does this project that I'm working on contribute to this goal or that goal? Is it more important than what this other person's working on? Do I need to start looking at something else?
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of the changes that we've made in the last year or two are adding structure to help with that.
Yeah.
So until 1 to 2 years ago, we didn't have any product managers. I started off kind of doing a bad job of that role kind of on the side. And then we didn't have any project managers or program managers.
Yeah.
And now we've got a program manager, we have a couple of product managers who actually sit within our marketing department, so provide that kind of interface between the customer needs and the development team. And we've got kind of sub-teams within our research team and our software engineering team where they have different areas of expertise. So for example, we have a mobile app, we have a web UI, we have back-end servers. So we've got a couple of people who are kind of experts in releasing mobile apps and building those mobile apps. We have a couple of people who are focusing on the back-end side. We have some people working on Stroke and some people focusing on certain imaging modalities within Stroke. Some people working on some of our new areas such as lung imaging as well.
Mm-hmm. So I think that completely transformational project really from 2.5 years ago, and whilst adding heads into it is difficult to do as you're going as well. So I think just how you set up as a business is incredible, and what you guys are managing to achieve whilst going through constant change is big as well. And to move on to constant change, the US is next, or is already on your radar, and is very much so.
Yeah,
very much landing, and we've been lucky enough to do some. Of your early hiring out there as well, which has been super exciting.
Yeah.
So just wanted to go back though a little bit in terms of territory selection.
Yes.
You were very European heavy.
That's right.
Early doors, and some great work in Spain, Poland and such as well as the UK. So why the US now?
Yeah.
And then how do you set up and validate for the USA?
Yeah. Okay, so to start with, why the US? So just to give an idea, stroke is it's quite a common disease. There's a stroke every 5 minutes in the UK, 100,000 per year. But obviously the US is a much bigger place, so you could easily multiply by five for the market size for the US. But that's not really the market size, that's just the number of strokes that are happening. The treatment rate in the US is much higher than in the UK and in Europe as a whole. So there's more thrombectomies in the case of stroke. Which leads itself to a greater need for software to identify the patients for those treatments. There's also much more money in the healthcare system in the US, and actually, shockingly, over 50% of the kind of stroke market is in the US. So worldwide, that is. In terms of spend.
Wow.
So yeah, if you've got the US, then that's basically as good as the rest of the world.
Yeah.
And working in lots of countries is really difficult. You've got different languages, you've got different healthcare systems, different ways of paying, different ways of funding. So Europe is definitely a bigger challenge from that point of view. Having said that, why do we start in Europe? Well, because we're based in Europe and we didn't know any better, right? So we started in the UK because that's where our contacts were.
Yeah.
We had contacts across the EU. Michalis is obviously Greek, so he's got an international background already. But and Iris was German, so we have some contacts in other countries already. But yeah, we started in the EU because we were a UK company. Our funding was from the UK. We wanted to do something for the local market, yeah. And that's the kind of links that we had. Now, there's different regulations in the EU and UK versus the US. So you've got CE marking for medical devices in the EU and UK, which may turn into UK CA marking, but that's a different story. And then in the US, you've got the FDA, and there's FDA clearances, typically 510Ks, which I won't go into now. It's a very exciting subject, but...
Yeah, but just to touch on that, you know, there is difference when it comes to AI regulation, right?
That's right.
Between European and US. Can you just touch on the difference? Because in my view, it seems a little bit easier to get a whole product in the EU when it comes to AI than the US, which is sometimes, you know, surprising.
Yeah, I think it depends on what you're doing. So there's in medical devices specifically, there are kind of two different general approaches. So the EU approach is that you develop your device, you describe it in lots of writing, and you do typically clinical evaluations and clinical studies to show that your device is safe and effective. So if you're doing a new device like we were with the Aspects, that's ideal. We could set up a project to do that. You have something called a notified body, which basically reviews your submission and says, yep, this looks okay. And then you can start to sell across Europe. In the US, there is a pathway for that, but it's much, much more expensive. It takes longer, it's more difficult. So the more common method for medical devices in the US is the 510K route. And these are essentially for devices with a predicate, which means something that's substantially equivalent to your existing device. Now, the devil's in the detail here, because lots of things, so an image storage system, a PACS, has acted as a predicate from 10 years ago for now the common AI devices you see today in some cases. So there's a bit of wiggle room in what substantially equivalent means. Mm. And actually those regulations have evolved a lot over the last 5 years. So it was a bit easier 5 years ago in the US to clear something that was maybe a bit novel as an AI device compared to now, when they've got much more defined categories for the type of AI device. So these days, there are fairly good, clear regulations, and it can be quite fast to get that clearance in the US, but you're a bit more constrained in what you can do.
Yeah.
And actually, this is a really interesting thing in terms of where the company is starting and when the company is starting as to what kind of product you'll get. As a simple example of when, we started around 2012, 2013 working on the product. Mobile apps and internet connectivity wasn't such a big thing back then, right?
Yeah.
Shocking to say, but you know, it wasn't easy to get, say, a medical image scan on a mobile phone. It would have been difficult to develop that product.
Yeah.
Now, these days, that's what everybody uses. But one of our US competitors started about 5 years after us, so they were in the sweet spot for being able to develop that. And that was a really smart move on their part, because they could go from scratch with a brand new product targeted primarily at mobile phones.
Yeah.
Now, we have also that product now, but we had to develop that as a kind of secondary thing, which is more difficult if you're not starting from that point of view.
Mm-hmm.
So timing is important. And then secondly, the location. Because you're kind of constrained by, let's say, US regulations, if you start in the US, you'll actually design a slightly different product, which gives you an advantage for selling in the US, but maybe gives you some restrictions compared to the EU, because we've done some things in the EU which you wouldn't have easily been able to clear in the US, which gives our product a bit of a leg up in the EU.
Yeah.
And this is where it gets probably back to your founding team.
Mm.
If they're based in one country, it's really difficult to start marketing in a different country, because you really need those personal connections and the links to be able to get those initial sites, the references, the evidence, and so on. So I think it was the right thing for us to start in the UK and EU, and we're now the UK and EU market leader, which is great. But it also means that it's more challenging for us to enter the US, where the incumbents are US-based companies. Yes, they've struggled more in Europe, but because the US is such a big market, that's still okay for them.
Yeah, I think the differences is always in how nuanced things are when it comes to all proven by the regulators.
Yeah.
I know there's been big moves by the FDA recently, especially when it comes to like cybersecurity and you know, privacy and things like that as well, to give more confidence to people, to enable innovators to innovate, but innovate within the restricted areas which you need to in medical devices.
That's right.
So what changes were needed within Brainomics to set up for US entry to market?
Yeah, great question. So the first thing we needed before we can sell clinically in the US is obviously regulatory clearance. And we didn't have that much experience of getting US regulatory clearance. So actually we went through a really painful period for a few years where we were trying to use consultants to do our US submissions, which took a long time, was quite expensive, and had, let's say, limited success. It wasn't as fast or as good as we'd have hoped.
Yeah.
So in the end, I think we finally learned from our mistakes. We hired the people directly with some experience, not necessarily within medical imaging, because again, that's very difficult, but people with some experience of medical device submissions in the US, or people who had the background that they could learn it quickly.
Yeah.
And we've actually been very fortunate in that our QARA department has expanded in the last 1 year from one person to six people. Mm. And they've done a fantastic job this year of being able to make those FDA submissions and get those clearances through while they learn about it on the job.
Yeah.
So we had some support from consultants to help them learn at the start, but after the first 3 to 6 months and the first couple of submissions, they were smart enough to have picked up all of that, and now they can just run with it themselves.
Yeah. And it goes back to your point earlier about saying, you know, smart problem solvers, just curious people.
Curious people who can learn, exactly.
Yeah, exactly, and you know, you might not be the best person in the room when you first start, but you will be soon.
Exactly, if you can pick things up quickly and you can learn quickly and you've demonstrated that, then that's fantastic and
it's
really good.
That sort of harks back to, I think, the Brainomics journey as well, just looking at simple hiring things like churn rates.
Yep.
You know, you have an exceptional retention rate in your business. To go through that journey of tripling in size and achieving great submissions, achieving new markets, whilst also keeping everybody and changing internal structures.
Yeah.
Goes back to the hiring principles you said at the start.
Yeah, I think it's very important what you say, because in a knowledge-based business like ours, staff retention is essential. If you've got somebody with 10 years experience of developing our product, it's going to be extremely difficult to replace that person, right? Yeah, we want to keep them. Yeah, well, and I want to keep my team as well. I think having the right staff incentives and rewards is important. As a startup, you obviously have a bit more flexibility with things like stock options, less flexibility with salary than big companies. So there's a bit of a trade-off there. But also you want to be able to support your staff so that they're enjoying what they're working on and that they see a career progression for them as well, which is obviously much easier to do in a startup where we're growing rapidly. People who were maybe a junior developer 5-10 years ago can now be like leading a department.
Yeah.
So there's definitely the opportunity to progress quickly, which is good for staff retention.
Yeah.
I think one of the other important points for entering the USA, apart from having the right staff in-house, is actually the location of those staff. So while the product development and regulatory team are mostly based in the UK, for the kind of field force, the salespeople, the customer support engineers, we really need to build our US team. And we've got some people there now, but we need to keep growing that because, I mean, there's simple things such as the time zone that matters. So if you've got a phone call at somebody from 5 p.m. on the west coast of the US, you don't want to be picking that up in the UK. And equally, you need to have those personal contacts and the ability to go and visit sites and being able to get that first-hand experience of how the system works as well. So this is where it's a real challenge, I think, especially for a UK-based company. you've got to kind of reconcile the different working practices in the US. There's a very different attitude to kind of hiring and firing in the US compared to the UK. That can be a benefit because our staff retention and the way of working can be quite attractive to some people in the US who might be used to a different way.
Yeah.
But then also you have higher salaries, you have different working patterns. So you've got to take that into account. And we talk about moving the center of mass of the company from the UK towards the US so that we can succeed there. And that means having a semi-independent US team who can run the show themselves rather than us trying to coordinate everything centrally from the UK.
Yeah, so they'll shift it into the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, hopefully Atlantis maybe,
Wiki. Well, I think, you know, really exciting times that are going to be coming up as well. And, you know, what would success look like for you in 2 years' time?
Yeah, so I think for us, it's getting a foothold in the US market. We want to rapidly grow our market share. Mm-hmm. We've got some reference networks at the moment, so we need to be successful with those, make them really love our product against the competition.
Yeah.
And then we can take it from there and hopefully expand our market share. So taking a small proportion of that market share in the next 2 years would be success for us, I think. If we can demonstrate success against our main competitors, then that's very promising for the future.
Awesome. And there'll be lots of people trying to get involved with it and help you out. So I'm sure there'll be people wanting to follow up with what you said today and people that wanted to know more about Brainomics, get in touch with you, with us, with anybody at Cypher or Brainomics. We're always keen to connect you with the best people possible.
Yeah.
So thank you very much for making the trip down. You're
thanks
based in
Nick.
Cambridge, not Oxford.
That's right. It's
always...
Well, I go between the two. That's right.
Yeah. They're yet to build that train line, which they always promise.
It'll get there in the end.
It would make everyone's jobs in life science much, much easier if they did.
It would.
But yeah, thank you very much for coming in, Eric. And once again, thank you very much for being a valued partner of Cypro. And we look forward to many years of continued success. And thank you very much for listening, guys. Hope you enjoyed this episode and delving into hiring plans, how to hire, who to hire, looking at US market entry, and also for those of you who were the early adopters of the podcast listening to Olivier's episode, I'm sure you're glad to get an update on the success of Brainomics. So thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Nick.
Sweet, awesome. You just have to wait for the end for them to edit.
Click.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much.
Cheers. Yeah, that was good.
Yeah.
Hopefully it was not too rambly.
No, not at all.
Bright sunlight.